Hello, everyone. David and Kim are out of town for their daughter's college graduation, so David asked me to preach. My name is Jared. If you're a guest with us this morning or you're new here, I just want to welcome you right now. Welcome. And also, there's a meet and greet area outside that door or the back door, and you can take a left out of there and you'll see some signs. If you want to hang out with me, we have a gift. I'd love to just chat with you. Also, after the service, there's going to be some people that will come down to the front of the auditorium, and they'll want to pray with anybody who wants to pray, and that's kind of their thing, and they'll want to do that for you after the service. So, I just wanted to start off by thanking everyone for welcoming and supporting me here over the last 2 years. I just finished grad school, and it's not something that I could have done without the dozen of me, including this one. So I'm looking forward to the next year with you. And I also wanted to thank you for welcoming my family a couple of weeks ago. They came here, they came down to Nashville for my graduation, and they came to church on Sunday, and they felt God's presence through your hospitality. So thank you for that. In return, today, I'm going to teach you about everything I learned in grad school. Everything I learned from you, and everything I learned in my classrooms, so buckle up. Paul sums it up throughout 1 Corinthians, but especially the first chapter, which we'll read that now. We'll start in verse 17 and go through 21. Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel. Not with wisdom and eloquence, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing. But to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. So I went up through fifth grade in a very small private elementary school, as in there were probably like three people in my class with me. I was the fastest at getting through my lessons, I had a good memory, and I always had my hand raised with the right answer. And I'll tell you, it made me feel really good thinking I was the most intelligent kid in the class. I remember one day, in like second grade, Mrs. Scholl told me to prepare a lesson for the whole science class, all four of us, in which I would describe the difference between mammals and reptiles. At the time, it was like the best day of my life to that moment. That's the kind of kid I was. I didn't really read the Bible a lot back then because it was in Old English, and I couldn't really understand it. But if I had read 1 Corinthians, I really would not have gotten it. Because what is this about God destroying the wisdom of the wise and the intelligence of the intelligent? What is that about? Paul is quoting God from back in Isaiah 29, verse 14. And why would God say something that would be so offensive to someone like me, who loves wisdom and intelligence and lessons and degrees? Why would Paul quote something so unreasonable? Well, let's step back here and go to the prophet Isaiah, who was talking to the nation of Judah when they were trying to be reasonable. And you know, Judah really had to be reasonable because they were dealing with such a delicate situation. You see, they were sandwiched between two giant nations who were at war with each other, Egypt and Babylon. That's what Judah's leaders were dealing with when Isaiah writes this poem about God destroying the wisdom of the wise and frustrating the intelligence of the intelligent. What are we going to do about Egypt and Babylon? these two giant nations, both at our doorsteps, both wanting to send their troops down our roads, Isaiah says to say out of it, keep peace. But why listen to him? So the king, he comes back from worship in the temple with some of the wisest and most intelligent people he knows, and they come to a decision about the delicate situation. We will be teaming up with Egypt. Thank you very much. They chose the lesser of two evils, and it seems like, by their calculations, they will survive the spread of Babylon's empire. Meanwhile, that crazy Isaiah guy is outside yelling something about staying out of it, but no thank you, Isaiah. We've really thought out all our options. Egypt is the best choice. 23 years later, Babylon has destroyed Judah and its temple, and 10,000 Jews are carted off into exile. I guess Isaiah's poetry wasn't persuasive enough, but at least he was right. The wisdom of the wise and the intelligence of the intelligent didn't really get those wise, intelligent people anywhere good. And let's not forget, Isaiah and Paul are writing to God's people, not some outsider think tank simply doomed for destruction, which brings me back to second grade. I still remember that science class with Mrs. Scholl. I was 10 years old and lecturing about the difference between cold and warm-blooded animals. Did you know, for instance, that more Americans die each year from bee stings than snake bites? Me neither. That didn't really have anything to do with their blood type, but that was the coolest fact I could find on short notice. All right. I'll tell you, the last thing I wanted to do during that lecture was to sound foolish. But let's reread. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Before we go back to my story about second grade, we need to talk some about this passage and its background. When you read the first chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul starts off by talking about some quarrels among the congregation about who is leading their church. Some say Paul is their leader, some say Cephas or Jesus or this guy named Apollos. Now, Acts describes Apollos as an eloquent man or a good speaker who God was using to do good work around the same cities as Paul. Now, apparently, the Corinthians were very interested in the kind of eloquence that Apollos brought with him when he preached them the gospel. That Alexandrian, Greek, toga-wearing, joke-making, tear-inducing rhetorical eloquence that the philosophers of the time were so submerged in. You might recognize this painting. It's by Raphael. That's Plato and Aristotle in the middle there. And they're wearing the coolest togas I have ever seen. You know, I think we should bring back ancient Greek fashion. Not modern Greek fashion, the ancient stuff, like with the togas. And we've kind of already started, because I know that a lot of women in here, a lot of queens, have those leather strap sandals that kind of go up the calf. You're wearing ancient Greek toga-esque fashion. And I'm just simply suggesting that we go all the way and wear togas like Plato and Aristotle. And I'm not getting very much consensus here, so I'm going to move on. But what I'm trying to say is that Plato and Aristotle, they were writing the books on rhetoric that made their ideas sound so good that we still think about them 2,500 years later. Books that Apollos had read, and now he, too, was quite eloquent. I bet Apollos sounded pretty good when he rolled into Corinth. He probably sounded better than Paul. But when Paul writes the letter, he reminds the Corinthians, hey, it's not about how good we sound, it's about what we preached. And it seems like the Corinthians were more concerned about who among them sounded the best or could make the best argument, or who had the best education, or maybe who had the best toga, I don't know. But can we just read this one more time? And I'll paraphrase here. Paul says, where is the wise person, the best educated? Where is the teacher of the law, the best Bible teacher? Where is the philosopher, the Plato, the Aristotle of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. In second grade, I did not own a toga. I was very interested and sounded very good as I gave those facts and lectured about the difference between warm and cold-blooded animals. I got a lot of positive attention, and it did turn out to be one of the best days of my life so far. That day, I learned more than the difference between mammals and reptiles. I learned what was going to be important for me for the rest of my life. Look smart, sound smart, be smart. That's what would get people to like me. That's what would get me the scholarships, the money, the attention in life, because that's what was going to set me apart. That's how I was going to be accepted. And that's been my life. Gaining the wisdom of the world, getting the grade. And I loved going to Bible college because there I wasn't just doing it for my teachers or my parents. I was getting it for God. I was setting myself apart for God. And it was like the higher on the class list I was, the closer I was to God. And by the way, the lower everyone else was on that list, the further they were from God and the worse they were than me. Now, I would never have said that back then, but it's something I've learned recently alongside new friends here and at school and while reading texts like 1 Corinthians. Because a lot of 1 Corinthians is about Christians who think they're better than other Christians because they know more about God. There are several examples about that in the letter, but I think this section about knowing something as mundane as what food to eat fits into our conversation. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. Paul says, "We know that we all possess knowledge, but knowledge puffs up while love builds up. Those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know. But whoever loves God is known by God." And that sums it up for me. If I ever get a tattoo, I'm going to get that on my face backwards. With this text in mind, I have three little nuggets to offer. First, if you ever think you really know something, that you really have it down, maybe even especially about God and the Bible, just remember that there are a lot of really good people out there who know a lot more than you about that thing, and they disagree. And I don't say that to throw you into an abyss of relativism, where learning is futile. In fact, I might insist upon the opposite. I just say that to help you when your knowledge is puffing you up. Good, smart people disagree with you. I have had a lot disagree with me to my face recently, and it has helped. Secondly, children and those with special needs make great Christians. It's probably part of the reason that Jesus likes hanging out with them in the Gospels. They just get it. They get that this whole thing we're up to called Christianity is about loving people and God. And I didn't learn that in a classroom. I learned that downstairs on Sunday morning. You get some kids into a small group and ask them about God, they'll tell you what's up. If you're a child here or have special needs, let me speak for everyone when I say that you are one of our greatest blessings and our greatest teachers. You deserve a toga. Thirdly, I want to just step out on a limb here to broaden what Paul is saying by asking this. What makes you better than everybody else? What makes you better than everybody else? Maybe it isn't knowledge, but maybe it's the number in your bank account, whether low, high, are just right. Maybe it's how often you come here. Maybe it's your political views, what news channel you watch, or what very pointed memes or articles that you like to share on social media. Sometimes when I'm scrolling on Facebook, I just want to scream this: those who think they know something do not yet know as they ought to know. And then I look in the mirror to see that my new face tattoo applies to me as well. You see, it's funny, but humility was kind of a new thing when Jesus came to show us what it was all about. No one thought humility was important in the ancient pagan world, and it was a medicine that didn't go down very easily. I want to go back to chapter 1 to see what reactions this foolish message about God has gotten as Paul has preached it. Let's read 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 22 through 25. Jews demand signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jew and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. We preach Christ crucified. That's where God shows us what humility looks like, on the cross. But that message is really weird and embarrassing for ancient Romans to stomach. I think that's something that we miss because of how normalized the cross is. But just imagine some things that you've seen out in public that have both shocked and embarrassed or disgusted you, and it was so bad that you had to turn away. I have a few examples, but I couldn't share them here. I couldn't share them at church. I sort of thought about how I could do it, but then a small voice inside of me said, "Think of the children." And then I gave it up. I've seen some things. That's all I'll say. The cross, too, was disgusting and embarrassing. But the fact that Jesus died on a cross is something that everyone seems to know, probably from a young age. We see crosses all the time, and Jesus' crucifixion is one of the most painted events of all time. And at the same time, our capital punishments are far, far more sterile than a crucifixion. You can't compare them. So let's think together about just what is so scandalous about a cross. Why it would be so hard for the Corinthians to both look good and sound smart while also talking about their master's crucifixion. Well, one part of the crucifixion that might upset our modest sensibilities was how the Romans insisted on the removal of all of the criminal's clothing, an idea reflected in every gospel. And I read into this to see if there was any kind of debate, especially considering no artist would ever even consider depicting that. There are some disagreements about whether Jesus was allowed a loincloth since his audience was Jewish and they would have been very uncomfortable with the graphic display of another Jew. But my suspicion is that the Romans didn't really care about what the Jews would have wanted, if the Jews had even cared at that particular time. So there's something perhaps shocking and definitely disturbing about Paul's foolish message that his Lord, like everyone who was crucified, would have been crucified without a cover, the highest embodiment of vulnerability and shame. Another thing I'd like to point out is the emphasis on prolonged suffering that Jesus went through on the cross. In even the most inhumane government-sanctioned execution, the idea is to get the whole thing over quick. Firing squad, gas chamber, electric chair, decapitation, they all go wrong when they last longer than expected. That's where the trauma could come in for the viewers. But the opposite is true for a crucifixion. The idea was to hold them there, vulnerable, for as long as possible, in as much pain as possible, so everyone would remember what Rome was capable of. And this would inevitably lead to even more shame, as we're not meant to take that kind of treatment, and the criminal would begin screaming and crying out, which we read in the Gospels that Jesus does on the cross. You might notice here that the outcome of crucifixion was pain, but the desired emphasis by the Romans was on public embarrassment and shame. In public, we typically do not like to cry, and we definitely don't want to be left without clothes. But when you're crucified, that's how people remember you. Dead, spread out on some hill or road for everyone to see as they pass by, shaking their heads. Have you ever had someone shake their head at you in public? Not a good feeling. Now, Paul writes that Jews and Greeks alike just did not get it. Just imagine being part of the Greco-Roman Empire, where you and everyone important has been reading Aristotle and Plato for 500 years. And suddenly, some dude comes into town saying, "Not Caesar, but this crucified guy is Lord." Must not have been very wise if that's where he ended up. And meanwhile, the Jewish leaders are rolling their eyes and pointing to Deuteronomy 21, verses 23, and saying, if someone gets that kind of treatment, be sure to bury it that same day, because anyone who is hung on a pole is under God's curse. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. What happened to Jesus was a desecration. He was cursed by God. It's there in black and white. And do you remember that place in Acts where Paul goes to Athens to talk to the philosophers and no one believes him? It's not because they're ignorant and closed-minded. It's because they're pretty smart and this message is foolishness. But God's power has a way of overcoming the wisdom of the world. We've heard the story, and as foolish as it sounds, we showed up today saying Christ is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Even if we look foolish, that's all we can say. Now, before we go on, I have to remind you, that's the message that Paul and Apollos have preached in Corinth. The problem was who the Corinthians wanted to act like. So they believed one thing and then proceeded to want to act like a toga. So here's an example of that from my life. Yes, I believed this message, but when I was a kid, I wanted to be like Bobby Fischer. And I realized that, last time I preached this, that a lot of people don't know who that is. He's basically just a famous chess player, Cold War guy. Yeah. He was good at chess and he was famous for it, so I wanted to be like Bobby Fischer. And then I wanted to be like my professors later on because they wrote books and articles and knew everything. Who do you want to be like? I bet they're famous for a reason. Numbers might have something to do with it. Let me read what made Paul and the apostles famous, as he self-reports in chapter 4 of 1 Corinthians. To this very hour we go hungry and thirsty. We are in rags. We are brutally treated. We are homeless. We work hard with our own hands. When we are cursed, we bless. When we are persecuted, we endure it. When we are slandered, we answer kindly. We have become the scum of the earth, the garbage of the world, right up to this moment. And a few verses later, he says, imitate me. Imitate me. Not Plato or Aristotle or even Bobby Fischer. He also says, I'm not saying all this to shame you, which I would echo here. The thing is, if we don't stop to recognize what we're called into through this story of Jesus that we're a part of, then we'll just bring in every un-Christ-like attitude from our culture of degrees and spin news and superstardom and stamp it as Christian. And I guess that every Christian in every culture has to struggle with their own attitudes. But I think Paul helps us here by pointing out the method of our struggle. That we believe God came to earth, but he ended up dead and ashamed. And many of us believe that too, but alas, Paul needed to write this letter for a reason. Because we might believe it without embodying it. In the summer of 2016, I was pretty fully committed to this message. I had already graduated from Johnson University with my Bible and preaching degree, and Lipscomb had accepted me into their divinity program. I had gotten a good job at Cisco, which is a food service distributor with a headquarters in Westbrook, Maine, where I was staying for the summer. Basically, my job was to go into this negative 10-degree freezer with this agile little forklift to run around, assisting these guys who had been working there for years doing this demanding job of lifting heavy, frozen boxes of food onto lifts that would barely make the tight turns in this giant freezer. So that was kind of a fun job, working nights with this really tough crew of guys. And they would give me a hard time because I was a Christian and they thought it was pretty funny that I was stuck working with them. But I loved those guys. We had fun. In fact, I'd say I couldn't have done that job unless I was working with people I could have fun with. There was one night, we were all standing in the break room warming up before going in, and it kind of came out that I was going to school in the fall to become a minister. As in, I wasn't staying past the summer. And I got made fun of, but mostly the guys thought it was kind of cool that I was doing what I wanted and I could do it, and they wished me luck. But I'll never forget it. That night, I was in the freezer, freezing. And I was working near this guy, Ryan, who was also freezing. And it was all pretty loud between the music and the machines, but he stopped me, which doesn't normally happen. And he shouted, "Why don't you stay here with us? We make pretty good money." And I said, still freezing, "For me, it's not about money. It's about what I feel called to do." Sounds pretty reasonable, right? And then Ryan said this, "You think you're better than us. You think you're better than us." I assured him he was wrong, but I don't think he was listening. He went off to do some hard work to provide for his family. I remember watching him and thinking, why would he say that? Why would he say that? And then sometime later, I wonder if he's right. Because Paul needed to write this letter for a reason. So that we're not just thinking about the foolishness of the cross, but so that we embody it, even in a freezer. Let me finish reading this section, and we can work around to applying some of this. Brothers and sisters, this is verse 26 and to the end of it. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential, not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. You see, the problem with all of this is that you can go out from here knowing that your wisdom or knowledge doesn't give you better standing with God. Or you can leave here knowing that you shouldn't let knowledge puff you up. You can leave knowing those things, but then let that attitude itself turn our noses up. That attitude itself can make us turn our noses up at those people who, quote unquote, think they know something. But don't forget what Paul wrote. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. Love builds up, and we need loving people in our lives all the time who challenge our culturally conditioned ideas about what matters. For me, I need people like Ryan who love me but are really just not that impressed with my degree, who might actually be suspicious about the importance that I have given it. I need people in my life who love me but are also different than me. And that's what God is up to. He called us to be together. That's what the end of this chapter is all about. And I like what Paul's wording is here. He says, not many of you, as in some of them in that Corinthian church, were of noble birth and had to get used to all the foolish and weak people that God had called them to hang out with. All the people with different opinions, different priorities, different bank statements, different news stations, different fashion senses, different invites to different parties, different people despised by the clubs we're a part of, but loved and called by God into the same church. A church that might look foolish to the world, a church that might make God look pretty foolish sometimes, but it's so that no one may boast before him. That's what I've learned in the last few years. That when we take a break from boasting for a little while, we'll see that God did something we could never expect or imagine doing ourselves. Dying that unreasonable, pitiful, and pitifully embarrassing death on the cross. And we notice just how wise and strong and good God was for calling us all together. Let's worship together.